from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, between a nuclear Iran, climate change, and a rising China, the challenges to U.S. national security are manifold. But in his new book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, Consul on Foreign Relations President Richard Haass argues that the largest threats to this country come from within. With second-rate schools, a decrepit infrastructure, and growing debt, Haass writes America should focus on improving itself. He'll join us in studio. Forum is up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Foreign policy expert Richard Haass, head for nearly a decade of the Consul on Foreign Relations, is now arguing in his most recent book for less foreign policy and greater emphasis on domestic investment and domestic policy reform. American profligacy at home, Haass writes, threatens American power and security abroad. And that core argument and what to do about it are at the center of his newest book, his 13th, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, the Case for Putting America's House in Order. Richard Haass served as Director of Policy Planning for the Department of State and as a principal advisor to former Secretary of State Colin Powell. He was Special Assistant to President George H.W. Bush and Senior Director for the Near East and South Asia on the staff of the National Security Council. He also served in the Reagan and Carter administrations and is a recipient of the State Department's Distinguished Honor Award and the Presidential Citizen's Medal. He joins us in studio, and that's a rarity. He's usually with us by phone. Richard Haass, good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Talk about your book. It's an important book, and I want to get to it, but let's talk about some things that are going on in the news right now and catch up on some foreign news, even though you're suddenly emphasizing the domestic to a much greater degree. Hundreds of pages of email on Benghazi. I don't know what we've learned in all these redacted emails or if we've learned anything more. The CIA is still going with their story and the State Department with theirs and the administration with theirs. And the GOP with theirs, excuse me.
If I were still teaching at the Kennedy School of Government, you could use it as a case study of bureaucratic politics, institutional prerogatives, each institution putting forward a set of talking points that puts them in the most favorable light or the least unfavorable light. I'm not sure there's a whole lot there when you do the archaeology.
A whole lot there in terms of whose culpability or why would the Marines stand down and all these kinds of things that we're hearing.
There's three different phases. There's the before it happened, should more security have been provided for the ambassador and his team? Answer yes. Some people at the State Department clearly made some bad calls. Once things began to unravel on the ground, I'm not sure, as Bob Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, said, I'm not sure then we had tactical options to do much. You can't respond and scramble that quickly. And then lastly, the question about whether the talking point process was somehow politicized. And the answer, again, it looks to me more like organizational and bureaucratic politics. Look, no one's ever drafted talking points where they want to come out looking bad. It's one of the first laws of government.
So we're really talking, in your judgment at least, about more of bureaucratic self-interest combined as opposed to real culpability?
Well, again, the bad decisions that had real consequences were the decisions made, if you will, before the crisis, not providing enough on the ground, on the scene protection for the ambassador, and mid-level officials at the State Department who made those decisions ought to have paid a real price for it, and I think several did. Unless there's something we don't know, that people actually had information and manipulated the talking points in order to protect, say, the political position of the White House 2 months into an election, unless we learn something more.
That's what ISA and the others in the GOP are saying.
Well, unless we see something more, I don't see, if you will, the smoking gun here.
Would you in the State Department have, because you're talking now about not isolationism, but clearly a much more emphasis on the domestic, not so much boots on the ground, would you have sent in much more help with, what you knew or what we know now?
Well, where I think the State Department security people erred was in allowing the ambassador to go to Benghazi at a time it was something of a Wild West. And it just looked to me like a misreading of the situation. They thought they were safer than they were. They may have believed or wanted to believe that somehow post-Qaddafi Libya was more stable than it was. And there may simply have been some bad calls by officials who basically were asked to provide more security. They chose not to. And I don't know exactly what intelligence and facts they were looking at. So that's a real case of Monday morning quarterbacking. But again, it was obviously the wrong decision.
But we're also hearing that the ambassador may have been involved in helping the rebels get more armaments. I mean, we don't know that, but certainly that's been surmised.
Again, I don't. You never know what you don't know, and that's clearly one of the things here. And the United States was involved in supporting the opposition at various stages of the Libyan crisis. That was the whole thrust of U.S. policy. This ambassador was different from many of his counterparts. He clearly got out of the embassy compound. He liked to mix it up with people. He spoke the language. He was very comfortable. But it just seemed to me to be a colossal misreading. Almost a naive misreading of what Libya had become. And I think there's a larger policy lesson there that when you get rid of the old order in these countries, when you get rid of the authoritarians who in many cases were repressive and were wildly unattractive, whether it was Gaddafi or Mubarak or whoever, what comes in its place is often extraordinarily chaotic and dangerous, and we shouldn't kid ourselves about that.
Well, that gets us right to Syria because certainly a lot of jihadists in the rebel movement and the civil war that's going on in Syria. And essentially in your new book, you argue for, you say, let's not get involved in so many things. We made mistakes, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, those were wars by choice. And so here we are facing a red line, at least the president has put down, chemical weapons. And certainly we should stay out of it, even though Tony Blair just told President Obama, why aren't you doing more?
Well, it's not a question of being involved or staying out. It's not a switch where it's all or nothing. We do have some humanitarian and strategic interests in Syria. I do believe we should be helping the opposition conceivably even more than we are. I for example, would be okay with the idea of providing so-called lethal aid to those opposition figures we were comfortable with. We obviously should be doing all we can to see that the consequences of the conflict do not, for example, undermine stability in places like Jordan or Turkey. So there's things we can and should do. But do I want to get involved militarily directly? No. If we did, yes, we could get rid of this regime. But again, then what? What we learned in all these situations that the aftermath could be prolonged and messy. There's not a place here for diplomacy. And all the opposition forces who want to get rid of this regime, the only thing they agree on is that Bashar al-Assad must go. They have divergent views on the future of the Syrian state, and this will be a prolonged but bloody struggle. So if and when we emerge from this phase, and if you will, this king is dead, then we enter what could be a phase that I think could go on for years and be extraordinarily violent and bloody, as we saw in Iraq, as we saw years before in Lebanon.
Well, you mentioned Turkey. They have become involved under Erdogan in this conflict, and the result is much more violence there on the border and possibly even within Turkey.
They become involved, but also in quite limited ways. The Turks are not going to get seriously involved inside Syria. You're not going to see Turkish occupation forces or something like that.
They're sending armaments. Yeah.
They're sending arms, as are several other countries, but that's largely an indirect approach. People have preferred outcomes. But from what I can see, no Arab country and Turkey and nor Turkey has the appetite to get seriously involved as a direct protagonist.
Talking with Richard Haass, who has written a new book all about foreign policy, but Foreign Policy Begins at Home is its title, and the case for putting America's house in order, its subtitle. And let's go right to the heart of what you're saying here. I mean, this is the biggest threat, as you see it, the enemy within. Shortcomings and failures are hurting us. Well, in fact, in terms of power and influence, in terms of competing in the global marketplace, and we've been overcommitted, so we have to draw back. And what does that mean in terms of drawing back? Does it mean no more foreign adventures, no more superpower, big stick? How far do we go with that?
Well, it's not so much that I want us to draw back across the board. Indeed, I want us to get more involved in Asia, where I think the United States could do more to keep the peace there as Asia begins to...
You want the pivot.
I prefer rebalancing, but I like the idea of the United States putting more resources diplomatically in terms of trade negotiations, in terms of air and naval forces in the Asia-Pacific region. That's where the great powers potentially collide. That's the core of the 21st century global economy. So I want us to do more there. But I do want us to do less of trying to remake the Middle East, what we've just been talking about. I think the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan and years before Vietnam is the United States has got to respect local realities. The United States has got to understand that the sorts of instruments we can bring to bear are not necessarily terribly useful or relevant to these conflicts. And I also believe the United States needs to think long term. We've got a luxurious situation in one way, that despite all the challenges and threats in the world, from Iran to North Korea to Syria to climate change, what have you, there's no great power competitor out there. The United States has some time and space to put its house in order here. And if we do that, we can discourage the emergence of a country that wants to take us on. We can deal with it if it does. But we've got to get stronger here at home, or we're not going to have the resources to be a great power well into the 21st century.
Well, at one point, you say global order presents no existential threats, and that struck me in a number of ways. I mean, when you not only talk about North Korea and Iran possibly getting nuclear weapons and so forth, I mean, there are threats from nation states, but there are also serious threats from jihadists throughout the world.
But none of these rises to the level, say, of a Nazi Germany during World War II, the mid-20th century, or the Soviet Union during the Cold War. There's no threat out there that I can see right now or I can envision anytime soon that is going to have the capacity and the inclination to take the United States on in a serious way across the board.
Talking with Richard Hassan, we'll bring you into this conversation in a bit. But I want to get into, the whole sense of where the power is distributed, which you write about also. United States, number one power, superpower, and so forth in the world. But you talk about the diffusion of power, particularly with the United Nations, the World Bank, the EU, NATO, but also with corporations and, for that matter, with the Arab League.
Oh, there's diffusion of power is one of the hallmarks of this age. That the U.S. share of global economy, we're about just over a fifth of it, which is another way of saying 80% is in other hands. You see political power, cultural power, military power. A bunch of guys with explosives can make a real difference. Hackers can make a real difference. Somebody with a computer. This is the nature of the 21st century world, and it's a very hard world to control or manage or steer.
And we've got China, for example, not only rising in power, but we are terribly indebted to China. And they are apparently, in fact, we had Eric Schmidt and your colleague Jared Cohen on with us talking about the Chinese threat from the perspective of cybersecurity. It's real.
That's real. But also with China, we got to look at the internal challenges to China. And I think it's very easy to exaggerate what China is or can be. And, the one thing I'm confident of is the next three decades for China will not go as smoothly as the last three decades.
And you seem to think that America can enter a new century, bringing about Henry Luce, second great century for America, based on taking on all of these problems that we have domestically. You mentioned climate change, for example, but international problems as well in a collective way, which goes back to, I guess, a kind of vision of the first President Bush, whom you worked with.
Absolutely. He talked about a new world order. I've often used phrases like integration, but what our goal should be to try to put together coalitions, arrangements, institutions out there to deal with this raft of 21st century challenges, from proliferation to keeping an open global economy to climate change to pandemic disease, what have you. We can't do these things alone. And what we ought to do is try to build arrangements around the world to sort these things through so they don't overwhelm us. I'd simply say that we had better take the lead in this. It's not unilateralism, by the way, but it's American leadership, because if we don't do it, no one else will. The alternative to an American-led world is not a China or Japan or Europe-led world. It's a nobody-led world, which is a euphemism, I think, for something that's messy or even chaotic. So the reason I actually wrote this book was to help sort this out, to basically say, stop squandering our resources on trying to remake parts of the world that are going to resist being remade in our image. Instead, focus our foreign policy where we can make a real difference and put our house in order. So then we will have the domestic basis for decades to come to act and lead in the world, to put together these coalitions to deal with the real challenges out there. But if we continue again to spend all of our blood, our treasure, our attention on things like the Syrias, the Iraqs, Afghanistans, as we have, by the way, for most of the time since the Berlin Wall came down, which is nearly a quarter of a century ago, we will squander this extraordinary historical opportunity.
But haven't we tried, to use your notion, international agreements and meaningful rules on an international level, tried it in the League of Nations, tried it in the United Nations, and the fact of the matter is, it might be, frankly, naive and a pipe dream to think that you can have teeth to these kinds of things and have agreement among nations.
Well, if your model is the League of Nations or the UN, it is absolutely a pipe dream. We now live in a world of, 192, 193 nation states. There's no way you're going to get consensus. And it's the reason, by the way, that global trade talks and global climate talks have all come to naught. But no one should assume or take the UN General Assembly as a model for anything. What we ought to do is build coalitions where we can. We have alliances, which are smaller. The new trade talks are not global trade talks. We have a couple of countries in Asia who we're negotiating with. We're trying now to negotiate across the Atlantic. Virtually every part of international relations, what we've got to do is say, what's the most realistic way to tackle this challenge? It might be with 5 or 10 countries that are like-minded or who matter the most. It might simply mean slicing off a part of a problem and dealing with that. We've got to get away from the idea that to act multilaterally in the world means bringing your problems to the UN.
But where's the teeth? I mean, multilaterally, we've certainly tried to do something about North Korea, and we've tried to do something about Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been a multilateral effort in both cases.
Well, in the case of Iran, the sanctions that have been into place are quite significant. Now, whether they'll be adequate or not, I don't know. And then we'll have to potentially make some difficult choices. In the case of North Korea, again, we've got a group of a half dozen countries that has put pressure on North Korea. But one country there matters more than all the rest put together, and it's called China. And the real question there is whether China is going to be willing to use its considerable leverage, not control, but leverage over North Korea. I would simply say in the last month or two, we've seen some evidence that it will. If you remember, 2 months ago, we thought we were on the cusp of a major crisis with North Korea. We thought the North Koreans might launch some kind of military action, and obviously it hasn't. My own reading of it is the Chinese leaned on them very hard, and the United States, I'm hoping, is telling the Chinese and the North Koreans that if North Korea acts aggressively, that will be the last Korean War, because the next crisis on the Korean Peninsula will end without a North Korea being a separate nation state. And I think for the first time, we're beginning to see that the new North Korean leadership and the Chinese understand that.
Let's talk about what you write a good deal about, this doctrine of restoration. What is it?
Well, it's a
doctrine. How do you envision it?
The idea is that we need to restore the foundations of American power. We need to restore the traditional balances. And what I'm really looking at is two balances. One is between foreign policy and domestic. I think we need to put more of our calories in the domestic basket for all the reasons you and I have been discussing. And within foreign policy, we need to move away from this fixation on the Middle East. And if I had my way, we would spend much more time thinking about Asia and much more time thinking about North America, the future of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. So that's my idea, is to restore the traditional, if you will, balances within foreign policy and between foreign policy and domestic policy. And it all adds up to what I think is a realistic approach or framework for long-term American national security.
We're talking with Richard Haass, who is president of the Council on Foreign Relations. His book, new book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, the case for putting America's house in order. And by the way, we certainly welcome your involvement in this program, and let me give you a very opportunity to express yourself and to join the conversation. There are a number of ways of doing that, of course. We'd like to hear from you, and you can call us at our toll-free number now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also join the conversation on our website, kqed.org, and our Facebook page, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @kqedforum. So you go to some domestic suggestions here, recommendations, and let's talk about them. Mm-hmm. Solving entitlement by raising retirement age and means testing, okay? This is going to get a lot of people agitated out here on the left coast, slashing corporate tax rate to attract jobs and investments. I just want to go through some of these. And this is also going to get a lot of people on the left coast angry. Enhance energy independence by building new nuclear power plants. But this was the one that sort of threw me. Oh, and I want to mention abolish the Electoral College. These are Richard Haass, domestic emphasis ways of moving forward and restoring. The one that threw me a bit was have these commissions, which would be unelected, draw up districts, congressional districts, that is. I don't even know if that's constitutional.
Well, it's happening in several states already. The idea is to get the process of drawing up congressional districts out of state legislatures. State legislatures are controlled by one or another party. It's good you're sitting down, Michael, but shockingly enough, the party that controls the state legislature tends to draw districts in ways that favor it. So what happens is effectively you create safe seats, and which has two effects. It tends to favor the majority party in that state. But more important, you no longer have districts where you have Democrats and Republicans coexisting. Increasingly, our districts are one-party districts, which allows candidates to essentially play to the end zones rather than to the middle middle of the field. And that's one of the reasons the House of Representatives is as polarized as it is.
So it's also polarized because many, many reasons that we could cite. But the reality that many people want to cite is the fact that money and politics can't be separated. And there's people who are – why not have term limits? Why not just have somebody run for one term of Congress and then be unable to run
The problem
again?
With term limits is always that you deny yourself the possibility of talent and experience. Look, there's a lot of mechanical approaches that I think would make the system better. I like the idea of open primaries. The reason I favor getting rid of the Electoral College is I hate the idea that when – look at the last election. 40 states of the 50 states are not even in play. So essentially, if you live in California or New York, the candidates avoid you. Your vote really doesn't matter. All the attention is devoted to roughly 9 or 10 states which are in play. And those states then receive tremendous money, special interests focus on them. But if politicians didn't have the luxury of ignoring 80 to 90% of the American people, money would have to be spread around much more thinly, like butter on the bread, so to speak. Special interests would lose lots of their influence. It would be a much more democratic, small-d political process. So I would like to see that.
You're becoming a domestic policy guy too here, aren't you?
Well, you have to. Look, this is a book I never expected writing. I'll be honest with you. I spent my entire career, 3 or 4 decades, thinking about quote-unquote foreign policy. But what got me to write this is not simply my frustrations with what we were doing abroad, which I thought was too much of the wrong thing in Iraq and Afghanistan, but what we're not doing right here at home. And at the end of the day, national security is bigger than foreign policy. National security depends upon getting it right here economically. And getting it right here economically and socially means getting it right here politically. We've got to get rid of some of the political roadblocks to dealing sensibly with the budget or rebuilding our infrastructure or coming up with a smart immigration system. I kept coming back to it. I didn't set out to write this book. I ended up writing this book.
And part of this vision includes slashing corporate taxes, which you have big corporations now paying no taxes at all.
Look, you've got corporations doing things, building plants abroad. What we want to do is get them to repatriate their profits. They're sitting on, what, $1.5-2 trillion worth of money? Why not get them to build plants here? And that will require several things. One is that they can bring the money back home without paying exorbitant tax rates. The highest nominal tax rates for corporations anywhere in the world are American corporations, 35%. We want to lower that. We also want to make sure that when they come here, they have the workforce they need. That argues for comprehensive immigration reform, allowing more highly talented, highly educated people to come to this country and stay in this country. It means improving our schools. It means improving our infrastructure. We really do need to take a strategic approach to fixing this country. And my guess is lots of people know that. So people shouldn't get hung up on corporate tax rates, but if they really care about jobs, and where are these jobs going to come from? Jobs are going to come from greater investment in this country. Who's going to make the investment? It's not going to be the government. It's going to have to be the private sector. That's called corporations. So we've got to create conditions where corporations are going to see all sorts of reasons to come back here. One has just happened.
This is also what we call a Republican talking point. Less taxes means job creation.
Well, again, we're not creating jobs, federal efforts to create jobs. There are things we can do, though the government can help. One is infrastructure. Create a national infrastructure bank. To some extent, that would help create jobs. Get corporations to do things here, to invest their money here. Again, that will work. One thing that's helping us is cheap natural gas. We've now become much more competitive. American manufacturing is undergoing something of a renaissance. This is not impossible stuff. This is not quote-unquote Republican stuff. This seems to me simply stuff that shows that's been shown to work.
And nuclear power plants with all that nuclear waste?
Well, we've obviously got to come up with a political answer. But, you know, I find it odd that people who care so passionately about climate change aren't thinking through, if you really care about it, the best approach to producing energy then is through nuclear power.
We'll continue with our guest, Richard Haass, and we'll hear from you when we return. His new book is Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, who's here with us in studio, author of Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. We started off by talking about Benghazi, and here's Chris, who writes on our website, there's only one reason that Benghazi is a scandal for Republicans. Obama was president when it happened. Oh, second reason, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State.
Look, I'm not going to sit here and say there's no politics involved there, but I also do think there's legitimate questions to be asked. An ambassador was killed in the line of duty. The question is, why was he allowed to be put in the first place in such a vulnerable situation? I think then the question is, might more have been done afterwards? And then obviously this the political question, what was the government's response proper and legitimate, or were politics involved? So I think in principle there's nothing wrong with raising the questions. I just think there's also no reason to have any rush to judgment here.
Another comment on our website: I appreciate Richard Haas's analysis. It's pretty solid, but I do think Americans are heavily brainwashed in foreign policy issues. The only acceptable perspective is that of American exceptionalism, where the U.S. is and should be the dominant global superpower.
Well, a lot depends on what you mean by the word dominant. I call us first among unequals. We're obviously the most powerful country out there, but that doesn't put us in a position where we can simply exert our will. If we could, Iraq would have been solved a lot sooner. Or Afghanistan and Pakistan would look a lot better than they do. Iran would not be moving towards nuclear weapons, and there'd be peace in the Middle East. So the United States, again, has more influence than anybody else, but there's still tremendous limits, and we've got to understand that. And one of the points I try to bring home again and again is local realities count. No matter what capabilities we have, look, we put 140,000 Americans into Iraq. 2.5 million Americans have served in either Iraq or Afghanistan. Neither one of those societies is close to being where we would like it to be. It should teach you a little bit of modesty and humility about our ability.
Not even necessarily friends of ours, you know.
Well, look at the Iraqis. The Iraqis now are helping the Assad government in Syria. They're providing fuel and arms to that. It just, again, it shows you not just simply there's no gratitude, but it shows you the limits to influence despite our preponderance of power.
Yeah, I guess it was Truman, wasn't it, who said it may not be an SOB, it may be an SOB, but it's our SOB.
History is going to have some very interesting questions when it looks back to what's happened in the Middle East over the last couple of years. And what we've seen is depart from the scene are a number of what were, to one extent or another, pro-Western despots in Egypt and elsewhere. And what we're now seeing them are replaced is often people who are despotic in a different way and anti-American. I'm not saying that we brought this about, but people who think that simply if we get rid of these authoritarian governments, all sorts of wonderful things are going to result or ensue. The Middle East has been a sobering lesson in realpolitik.
By the way, let me thank someone who tweeted, and I misspoke. I said Tony Blair, and I obviously meant David Cameron, who President Obama's meeting with. We also asked listeners on Facebook what they think is the largest threat to U.S. national security. Let me read a few of these. Religious tyranny, Lale says. Dimitri writes incompetence. Michelle says climate change. And Kathy says corporate and personal greed. Let me get to your calls. And let's go first to Maya in Greenbrae. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me well?
I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. This is the second time in a month that I'm calling, but you keep talking about foreign policy and immigration, all that stuff, and these are topics that are dear to me. I grew up in the Middle East, and it's funny. I'm just calling to reaffirm that what your guest is saying is absolutely true. My 16-year-old self could have told the administration that just because you remove the authoritarian, the dictator, doesn't mean that what's left wants democracy in its true form. That is, everybody, all the factions have an equal say, not at all. And while my heart just goes out to the civilians, to the people who are suffering these horrific atrocities, and all they're waiting for is for a guardian angel, a savior, to come in and just remove the dictator. At the same time, I think that there's no good solution because there is no unity amongst the people of these different countries. There's so many factions. There's so many different religious affiliations. There's so many different understandings of the separation of church and state. So, what your speaker is saying is absolutely true. Why does the U.S. administration not know this better? There are enough Arab Americans living here. Why can't they get true intelligence about culture and mentality in the Middle East?
All right, Maya, I thank you for that call. And brings up another question, really, when she talks about all the divisiveness in different countries and the difficulty of exercising superpower hegemony and all that. What about moral crises? I mean, Rwanda, Bosnia, I mean, where is the United States' role there if we're going to be putting more of our emphasis on the domestic?
We're going to have to look at these situations one at a time. We're going to have to look at what we think we can accomplish and what it will cost us. We've got an all-volunteer army. We've got to think about what we would ask these young men and women to do, and also how long we would have to do it, and again, at what cost. You've always got to think in these decisions, not just with your heart, but with your head. And you've got to say, what are the direct costs? What are we likely to accomplish at what cost? And what are the indirect costs? If we do this, what maybe can't we do? And that simply – and might mean in some situations you act, in other situations you don't. I write at one point in the book that inconsistency is a virtue. It's certainly a necessity. Well, but people who are hoping for one-size-fits-all foreign policy, we're always going to get engaged in these awful situations, they're going to be disappointed, and we just simply don't have that that luxury.
I had Secretary of State Albright on. She admitted that not doing something vis-a-vis Rwanda was the biggest mistake she felt she made. And I guess former President Clinton has said pretty much the same thing.
It may well have been. But I would say that should only be the reaction if we have high confidence that we could have done something at a modest cost that would have had extraordinary results. But look at what – yeah, we had 140,000 troops at the max in Iraq. We were there for a decade. And the results simply are in no way commensurate with that investment. Why does anybody think, for example, that if we were to get into Syria now – these warring factions would suddenly lay down their arms, and the lions would lay down with the lambs. It wouldn't happen. This is going to be a fight to the finish. It's awful. One's heart goes out to the innocent people who are caught up in it. But we've really got to ask ourselves, what can we realistically accomplish, and at what direct and indirect cost?
More responses on Facebook to the question, what do you think is the largest threat to U.S. national security? Misha says a two-party system, which is by nature divisive and corrosive. Joshua says debt. Chris says our obsession with national security. And Kenji writes, can we define national security first? If a lot of our people are chronically at risk of going without adequate nutrition or shelter or medical care, but no act of mass violence against us can go without reprisal, then is that national security? What are we securing? I'm going to secure another caller. And John, that's you. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. And I just want to make a couple points first. And I have a quick question here, mostly about multilateral institutions. And, I mean, from us torpedoing Kyoto to bypassing the U.N. Security Council to go to war with whatever our taste du jour is that day, to austerity policies that really punish people through the IMF and World Bank programs, I mean, I think it's kind of disingenuous to ignore the fact that the inefficacy of these institutions also comes from our refusing to sign on to the ICC and also scuttle whatever the rest of the world wants to do over our own personal interests. I guess that's just a point to make. So I guess what would your specific proposal be in developing these relationships you're referring to, Mr. Haas, about strengthening these relationships? I'll take my comment off the end.
All right. Thank you for the call. Richard Haas.
I'm not quite sure I understand about strengthening relationships, but what we want to do is come up with collective responses as best we can. But take the UN Security Council now on Syria. Countries such as Russia and China want no part of getting involved there. It's not simply that they have narrow interests in Syria they want to protect, but they also want to reinforce the idea that sovereignty is an absolute. They don't want the world to get involved in their internal affairs. So if you wanted to get more involved in Syria, one of the questions you'd have to ask yourself, should we give the Russians and the Chinese a veto over that simply because they're sitting in the Security Council? And I would say no. I would say it should be a consideration, but we might decide that morality or simply hardcore national security interests require that we act and work around the United Nations. I don't think we can give the quote-unquote international community or various institutions a veto over it is what we think is that needs to be done in the world. So I have a fairly pragmatic approach. I work with these institutions when we can get a consensus that I believe is consistent with our national interests. But when I can't, when we can't, then I would say we find other mechanisms. For example,
superpower strength and muscle, maybe. I mean, when you talk about Russia and Syria, I mean, Russia has been a longtime ally of Assad's and a longtime supporter of Assad's, and frankly, supporting them when the United States labeled Syria a terrorist state. And so you get into a possible kind of neo-Cold War conflict when you start looking at this in the light of day.
We're in an age where countries are not going to be adversaries or allies. The president said it about Egypt. The statement could be said more broadly. Countries like Russia, countries like China, we're going to agree on some issues. We're going to cooperate in limited ways, but we're going to disagree on others, and we're going to find ourselves on opposite sides. of various equations. And when we do find ourselves that way, hopefully we can talk about the differences, limit them. But this is simply, you talked before about a world of diffuse power. This is the 21st century. It doesn't line up quite so neatly. It's a much more dynamic world. It's actually a much more difficult world to navigate. People in the diplomacy business are going to find the 21st century in some ways much trickier than the 20th century, given these shifting coalitions, all these actors out there who aren't nation states. It's actually a very complicated, in some ways, it's more complicated than ever.
Boy, and the 20th was complicated enough. Let me get some more callers in here. Colin, join us. You're on the air with us.
Good morning. Professor House, my question, I'd like you to clarify your remarks on war with Iran, Iran not representing an existential threat to the U.S. Is it your opinion that getting involved in a war to preempt Iran's nuclear weapons program would be a war of choice? And what would be the cost to the U.S. in pursuing such a conflict? Would we have to invade and occupy the country to ensure that they would never have the capability to develop nuclear weapons? If we're not prepared to do that, is the rhetoric by President Obama, last year he made an appearance before the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and said that essentially all options were on the table. Is that an empty threat? And is it is that type of rhetoric essentially creating a situation where the Iranian government doesn't see any interest in negotiating?
Well, look, thanks for your question. I actually think you put your finger on what I found when the writing of this book to be the single toughest traditional foreign policy choice facing the United States. I don't much like either option. I know the option of going to war against Iran, which would be a war of choice. We could accomplish certain things. You know, what we don't know would be what would be the Iranian response, what would be the consequences in the region or within Iran. To allow Iran to get to have nuclear weapons, I think, would be extraordinarily destabilizing for the region and possibly beyond. It's the reason that, therefore, I strongly favor a version of what we're doing now, which is a combination of sanctions and diplomacy to try to get the Iranians to accept limits on their nuclear program that we and the Israelis, among others, could tolerate.
Israel, in fact, under Netanyahu, has used that direct phrase, the existential threat, as far as Iran is concerned.
And they may feel that, and if that's the case, at some point they may act if Iran goes far enough. Again, what I'm hoping is that we can avoid a situation where the United States has to choose between a preventive military attack on Iran or accepting an Iran with nuclear weapons, because I believe either would be an extraordinarily costly outcome. But I do think it has the potential to be the most difficult national security decision in the traditional sense that the United States could face over the next couple of years.
Christine writes on Twitter, Michael, did you miss the We Draw the Lines project here in California, where a nonpartisan commission redrew our own districts? Good point. Thank you for that. Listener writes on our website, please, Mr. Haas, everyone knows that there is solid proof and data that giving corporations tax holiday has not increased jobs in this country or improved the life of people. It has improved the life of shareholders and CEOs in the corporation because corporations bring in $2 to $3 trillion sitting outside our country, inside tax-free, then pay unjust bonuses and buying their own corporation stock to hold their stockholders. Who owns stock? The top 5%. The other retirement stocks and poor people stocks are being pirated in waves of Wall Street-controlled ups and downs.
We could have a long philosophical conversation about corporations. I would simply say that I want corporations to invest more in the United States. I want them to bring those profits back home. Some of them are starting to, again, because of the comparative advantages that are stemming from low natural gas prices in this country. But my view is if taxes are lower, that if we have the workforce they need through immigration and education, we give them the infrastructure they need so we're more competitive, I believe they'll bring that a lot of that money back home, and that will, among other things, create economic growth and jobs.
Well, you're getting a good deal of blowback on this. Let me just read another email from a listener who writes, his take on corporations. He needs to think harder about how to get corporations to bring their jobs and investments back to the U.S. Corporations don't spend 39% in corporate taxes today because of all the loopholes. He knows this and needs a more innovative approach to getting corporations to reinvest in America. Well, that's the whole outsourcing thing. He's right about it.
But there's going to be less of it, I believe, as wages go up around the world. And again, as we become more competitive, corporations are rational. They make fairly hard-headed decisions. They want to maximize profits. So when the United States becomes a more attractive place, and there's many things going for us. I've already talked about energy. We've obviously got political stability. We have a lot of talented people. So there's lots of reasons for corporations to invest and build here. And what we've got to do is put more things on the positive side of that list of considerations. And I think if I had to predict, by the way, I think there's a decent chance that will happen. I'd love to see comprehensive immigration reform passed. I'd love to see a national infrastructure bank put into existence and things like that begin to happen. One other thing that I'm not sure if we mentioned, these new trade talks, if those come to fruition, the potential for American exporters will be great. And again, more reasons for corporations to build here at home.
But you got so much polarization, you couldn't even get a watered down background check after Newtown. Nothing.
That's the most worrisome thing out there. Again, it's the dysfunctionality of American politics, the fact that 90% of the people in polls would favor background checks, those who are against though carried the day. And that's again, in part why I wrote this book. I am genuinely worried about what's happening here at home politically with all the consequences. I'm intrigued by the idea of Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, and others to build grassroots, if you will, counter special interests against groups like the NRA. If you're like me and you think that what's going on in the area of entitlements is crazy, then I'd love to see some groups take on the AARP. What we need to see are, in a sense, special interests fighting the special interests. And in the long run, hopefully the national interests will be served.
Listener named Matt says Democrats got over 1 million more votes for House representation than Republicans, but Republicans control the House by something like 20 seats. Perhaps we would have more valid representation at home if we found a way to tackle gerrymandering. Another listener, Bill, writes, at 30,000 feet, Richard is exactly right, but given that financial oligarchs fund politicians, it's unlikely that any significant policy decisions can occur that don't align with financial industry initiatives. There is little appetite or courage for independent thought in D.C. Rick from Palo Alto says, so what does the U.S. do if Israel is nuked by Iran, or perhaps Pakistan loses a nuke to one of the multitude of terrorist groups and this little device ends up in New York City?
Well, I'm glad he raised Pakistan. It's interesting. You know, we spend so much time in the foreign policy debate talking about Syria or talking about Iran possibly getting a nuclear weapon, or North Korea, which has maybe a half dozen or eight or so. Well, Pakistan has hundreds. Pakistan has the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world, bar none. Pakistan also is home to a larger number of the world's most dangerous terrorists than any other country. This is a country of 185 million people. It's to some extent a failing state with very weak political civilian leadership.
With new election and new leadership.
And we'll see what, if any, difference it really makes, because the security services and the military really control the big political decisions. So if there is a scary scenario out there, I think it's much more likely to stem from Pakistan than from any other country.
You're on board with Bill Clinton on this. You know that he said the most dangerous and volatile place in the world, he believed, was not the Middle East, Israel and Syria, et cetera, but Pakistan.
I remember my first conversation with Colin Powell when he became Secretary of State. So we're going back now, 12 or 13 years ago. And we spent an hour and a half together. It was his first day on the job. We were talking about all the issues out there. And he said, well, what's the one thing that keeps you up at night? And I said, oh, that's easy. It's Pakistan. And in some ways, 9/11 was related to that because of what the Pakistanis are helping about in Afghanistan. But as I look toward the future, it's the nightmare scenario, given that you've got all this nuclear material, and this is a country that's not functioning as a traditional nation state. There's a lot of fault lines within Pakistan. There's tremendous anti-Americanism. There's a lack of capacity. Look at the whole Osama bin Laden situation. Either the Pakistanis didn't know that Osama bin Laden was in Abbottabad, which is not a reassuring thought, or they did know that he was there, which is not a reassuring thought. So either you have a country with a lack of will or a lack of capability to be responsible. Either one has got to make you uneasy.
So something did break out with respect to Pakistan, and there's still tension over Kashmir between Pakistan and India. You still have problems in the Korean Peninsula that could break out in a serious and severe way. The United States has to take a preeminent role, doesn't it?
For sure. And this is not a book that advocates isolationism. And there will be situations of necessity where we have to get involved, or in some situations we may choose to get involved. What I'm simply saying is we should not continue to get involved in situations where our vital national interests are at stake and our tools are not particularly relevant and where the likely costs and benefits of getting involved don't make sense. This is not a tract in favor of isolationism or withdrawing from the world. That would be folly. Our borders aren't barriers. We can't be a gated community. But it is a book that argues for strategy. It's a book that argues for choice, for priorities. We can't do everything everywhere. We've got to, in some ways, keep in reserve capacity in case some of these nightmare scenarios should pop up, or in case a country emerges in the world in 10 or 20 years that is a real rival. Let's just be smart. Let's husband our resources and let's rebuild here at home so we can meet these challenges if and when they come at us.
Well, I saw an editorial you did in the Wall Street Journal, and you said the president has too much latitude to order drone strikes, and that would be in keeping, essentially, with the thesis of this book, and it would also perhaps countervail the growing burgeoning of terrorists because of drones in Pakistan?
Drones are a tough call. My view is that we've used them a little bit too frequently. And I'm not against using them per se, but before you use them, you've got to be really sure, again, that whatever you're likely to accomplish is not going to create more of a problem. Remember Don Rumsfeld's old line about, are we sure that what we're doing in the name of counterterrorism isn't producing more terrorists? So before you shoot off a drone, you've really got to ask yourself, is the target worth it? Are we likely to get the target? What about collateral damage? How might it alienate the government or the society? I'm not against using them when the criteria are met, but it can only be when the criteria are met. It's got to be an exceptional instrument, not a casual instrument.
Should it have been used against an American citizen, Al-Hawaki?
That to me is the toughest call of all. I would simply say that we're in a situation where there's we're in a state of war. I would simply say when an American's involved, the criteria or the standards for use have to be extraordinarily high. And then I would say have a legal process where you could bring that. We have other sort of extraordinary legal processes where we do things. What I think the administration needs to do is come up with a more formal decision-making process. So if we are going to contemplate actions like that, we go through a process that Americans essentially have confidence in.
We're talking to Richard Haass. His new book is Foreign Policy Begins at Home. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we go to another caller. Neil, that's you. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Yeah, I'd like to know exactly how you would define a just or necessary use of force by the United States in foreign policy. Would the British action in Sierra Leone be considered some kind of a model for how we should act?
You know, I'm not familiar with all the details of that. Obviously, you know, the most basic form of justified use of force involves self-defense. It's implicit in – or explicit, rather, in Article 51 of the UN Charter. So any country has the right to do that. It gets a bit murkier when you want to do other things. For example, if you want to intervene in countries where genocide or something like it is taking place, is that a legitimate use of force? And there is a doctrine, so-called the responsibility to protect, that would say yes. But there's lots of gray areas here, and I think in each one of these cases, we've got to argue it out, and we've got to decide what we're prepared to support or defend in both domestically and internationally. But there's going to be a lot of close calls. You're not going to come up with definitions that are going to be clear. You can do X and you can't do Y.
Let me thank you, Neil, for the call. Go right to another caller. Emery, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if everything that you presented came to pass – Everything that you want for this country, what would our country look like?
What our country would
Thomas look- More's utopia.
Yeah.
No, it wouldn't be that. But it would be a country that would be growing at our historical average. We're now growing at roughly a half to two-thirds the post-World War II average. I would like to get us back up to the post-World War II average, which is somewhere close to 3.5%. I would like to see Americans be more tooled or equipped to meet the challenges of a 21st century competitive world, which would mean improving our educational system. Look, kids line up to come to the great universities in this country to go to Stanford. No one lines up to go to our public elementary and high schools around the world. I'd like to see us essentially have a society where also there's access to education throughout our lives. So, again, people can stay employed in meaningful jobs. And around the world, what I'd like us to do is be in a position where we could help keep the stability and order in the major regions, where we can continue then to have trade and investment, and where we can begin to knit together something of a global response to some of these global challenges. If we don't, whether it's climate change or the spread of nuclear materials or disease or what have you, these situations could potentially overwhelm us. So, you know, my whole argument is that we're not going to get the necessary global responses without U.S., without effective U.S. leadership. So this is not the utopia that I'm talking about, but it is a situation where American society does quite well, the American economy does quite well, and there's a relationship. If we do better, the world will do better, and if the world does better, we will do better. It goes in both directions.
Let me thank you for the call, Emery. Again, we're talking with Richard Haass, who is president of the Council of Foreign Relations and author of Foreign Policy Begins at Home. Let me say to the, this is Noam Chomsky who said that the CFR, the Council of Foreign Relations, is all about business input into foreign policy, that you represent the business interests.
Like much of what Noam Chomsky says, it doesn't bear scrutiny. Look, the Council on Foreign Relations, we're nearly 100 years old. We're a membership organization of Americans around the country. We're truly nonpartisan. We have people on both parties and independents. We're independent in the sense that we don't accept a penny of government money. We don't accept we don't take institutional positions. The Council on Foreign Relations doesn't stand for this or that position. I have my own personal views. So do other people affiliated with it. Our journal, Foreign Affairs, is the leading journal where foreign policy debates are waged. Our website, CFR.org, is actually I think the best single resource online to go to for fundamental information and analysis about the world. Sure, we also have corporate members. Corporations, the last I checked, have rights too. They're part of the American
– have rights that individuals have, in fact, according
to Citizens
United.
Exactly, and they're an important part of the strength of this country. But what we're trying to do is be a resource so that the conversation you and I are having here today and with these callers, that essentially these conversations happen more often. And when conversations do happen about this country's role in the world and about this country's national security choices, they're smarter conversations. So our goal is essentially to be a resource. So the consideration about the world, about what the United States should and should not do in the world, that this conversation is essentially a smarter one.
Well, it's been a good conversation, and I thank you for being with us. Again, Richard Haass's new book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. Good to see you.
Always a pleasure.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. I want to remind you also that you can continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum. Also, Tina Lauerberg producing this week. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer Raul Ramirez. And our interns are Nora McCartan, Jasmine Wynn, Stefan Norgard, Kelsey Dayton, Olivia Barnum, and Maddie Pelton. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.